Well, hello, everyone. My name is Bliss Baker, and I'm head of the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance. And that alliance was the brainchild of three of the people on the stage today, Gord Quaitini, Rob Verhoot, and Bob Dineen. And we're a global alliance, as the name suggests, and we deal with issues at the international level. So when people like the World Bank spend $8 billion on oil projects last year and not a penny on biofuels projects, we ask them very publicly why they don't have a biofuels policy. And when the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization reduces agricultural subsidies and support programs yet again for the 10th year running, we ask them very publicly why it is they're not investing in agriculture in developing countries. We also remind them that when they comment on biofuels and the fact that we might be using food for fuel, we ask them why it is that there are 50 million hectares of land in the Ukraine alone of unfarmed land that is sitting there, and the UN has ignored that issue and is not supporting development of those agricultural lands that could easily provide food and fuel for all of Europe. So those are the kinds of issues we take on, and later on this week we'll take on the G20 when the finance ministers meet in Paris to discuss the world's economy and how that they can breathe new life back into the global economy. We'll be reminding them that in 2011, world oil subsidies will probably surpass $400 billion, and they will be sitting around a table in Paris discussing ways to revive the global economy. I've got at least one idea for them, and we'll be reminding them of that on Friday. So those are the kind of issues that we tackle. We have a great panel here today, five gentlemen who represent industry associations that produce probably 85% of the world's biofuels production, from many, many, many countries. They bring to us a very diverse perspective on the industry. And with years and years of experience, these gentlemen have helped shape global biofuels policy in a variety of countries. And so they bring to us today a very unique perspective on the biofuels industry from a global perspective. This panel, we like to have a little fun. The Global Alliance was brought together because we had some interests in common, but there are certainly a number of interests that we don't share. And so without further ado, why don't we start the bun fight? And maybe we'll start with Marcos. I noticed you grew a beard for this panel. I'm sure it had nothing to do with the gentleman sitting to your right of you. Marcos, Unica has been, Marcos represents Unica, the Brazilian sugarcane industry, ethanol industry. And they've got a very a policy on the tariff, U.S. tariff, ethanol imports. Not sure if it's changing at all. Maybe you can bring us up to speed on that, your position on the tariff and Unica's position on that issue.
Okay, so thank you very much for this invitation, Bob, RFA. We are very glad to participate again in this event. And first of all, I'd like to say happy 30th anniversary to RFA. I think this is a great date. And I was questioning myself if after 30 years, the industry is not now a mature industry, which means that if the industry still needs subsidy or not, still need the tariff or not. So I think this is the first answer to your question, Bliss, because today the U.S. industry is the largest industry in the world, no? If I understand well, let me take some figures here. It's the number one ethanol producer in the world, doubling the Brazilian production. Corn ethanol is more competitive than sugarcane. And some industry leaders here say that ethanol is the cheapest motor fuel in the world that you can buy today. I don't know if it's true or not, but there are also people say that we are even cheaper than Brazilian ethanol today, because we can make it more competitively than they can. So I think it's time to lift trade barriers and create a free market. The U.S. is now a net exporter of ethanol, near 400 million gallons in 2010. It's using subsidized exports to Europe. I think Rob will talk a little bit about that. So it's not time now to talk about free trade. I was so happy yesterday, for example, in a panel here, in a session, named Where Are Our Export Markets and How to Get There? Bob, 3 years ago you said, At RFA, we advocate that each country should take care of its own markets. I hope that in 3 years, you'll be a free trader as we are. So
I think
it's time to eliminate the tariff. It's time to fight together for trade. It's time to compete. This is my point, only that.
Marcos, first let me say, you get 3 demerit points because we're not supposed to have notes up here. These guys, it's not fair. None of these guys have notes and you have notes. So you get a couple demerit points. But George Fitch runs the Caribbean Ethanol Industry Association, is probably sandwiched in between some of these tariff and trade issues, and he probably has a unique perspective on this issue.
Totally different one.
Shocking.
We're on the totally opposite side of Brazil on the tariff issue. If Brazil loses the tariff issue, they still live for another day. They can go and get new markets. They can continue to supply or export to Japan and Korea. And now they've got renewable exotic chemical markets they can go after if they find that they indeed have supplies to export, because it's very tight. So the question then becomes, if you no longer want to use the Caribbean Basin as your free trade mechanism to go to the United States, and you want to take away the tariff, which will basically, and without exaggeration, it's the death knell. You take away the tariff, the 8 2B9 plants in the Caribbean Basin, pack it up, go home, suck up a $320 million investment, 650 million capacity, 850 million gallon quota. You kill them off. And what are you killing? You're killing what the United States International Trade Commission said was the most successful industry generated by the Caribbean Basin Initiative. So why go through all that? Especially since the U.S. government has told you, if they haven't already, that the tariff is not WTO actionable. You can't go there and say this is unfair, this is trade distorting, and therefore we're going to file under the subsidies code or a countervailing duty. This is in a lockbox. If you want to succeed, Brazil, in removing the tariff, you've got to go to the U.S. Trade Representative's office and State Department and say, would you please open up that lockbox, which you, back in 1994, in your schedule that you gave to all the GATT trading partners, where they all looked at your lockbox and said, that's okay, we don't mind, go ahead and keep that in there. So now you got to go open up that lockbox, pull out the ethanol tariff, the 54%, then close the lid back on the lockbox. Well, the U.S. government's not going to be too thrilled to do that, especially when shortly thereafter, all the 26 countries in the Caribbean Basin are going to go to the State Department and say, whoa, you can't do that. And then they'll probably get all the countries of the Asia-Pacific Caribbean under Lome to say, this is totally unfair and totally trade distorting. So what you're doing is you're creating trade hostilities that you don't need to create. And I was surprised when I heard about this last year, about how Brazil was going to go after the tariff. So I called over, because in a former life I was involved in trade policy, I called over to Ron Kirk's office and said, is this true? He said, well, you know, they haven't even done the first step yet. And the first step is you have to call for consultations. So I'm trying to think, why is Brazil making all this noise about how they want to shut down the tariff? Well, because they want to lobby the young congressional staffers on the Hill who don't know too much about this because there's no history to them, to try to get it changed. But so I would encourage Brazil, there's a better solution to this. We keep all that production capacity, all that success that we have in the Caribbean Basin, and continue to go to the U.S. market that way with all these established links. And I would think that Unica might want to use this as an initiative on their part, like what the Americans did in 1984 with the Caribbean Basin Initiative, where Brazil now can have their own Caribbean Basin Initiative and they can basically reach out to the Caribbean Basin as one of the leaders of the Doha Round to help countries that are not as developed or as advanced as they are in this very important era, and encourage their mills to ship their hydrous to the Caribbean Basin, as opposed to getting into what could be a very nasty trade fight by trying to go after the tariff.
Yeah, we're clearly not going to solve this issue here, but Bob, you probably have a comment on this issue.
And here I sit between two good friends. George Fitch and I go back to 1990 when we cut that deal on the CBI that would allow 7% of the U.S. market to come in duty-free for my good friend Marcos Yank. And that program has indeed been very successful, and I want the Caribbean producers to be able to continue to succeed. And my good friend Marcos. And we are good friends, and I like the beard. And we are now, you know, such a good supplier to your country. We're there in your time of need because you haven't been able to produce enough ethanol to meet your own needs. We're now exporting to you, which I think is great. And as we ship ethanol to Brazil, I haven't gone down to Brasilia asking for separate treatment, asking for some of the incentives that still benefit Brazilian producers, the reduced tax rate, the export enhancements that you build, the pipeline that you build, the loan guarantees, the 30 years of subsidies that have helped to build a very successful industry. You know, Marcos, I've looked up to you over the years because you have indeed built a great industry. But we've done the same thing here. And my position today remains as it was a couple of years ago, when I've been to conferences of yours in Brazil and where we spoke in an international fora elsewhere. I do think it's critically important that nations be allowed to invest in and create their own domestic ethanol industry without having to subsidize the ethanol of another. And I think that that is still a critically important position that we should all adopt. Look, we ought not be trying to carve up the pie and go after each other's industry. The real battle here is how do we grow the international biofuels market such that we are taking more and more out of petroleum. That should be the goal. That should be our collective opponent here. That's the objective. How can we maximize the production of all of our renewable fuels and minimize and reduce the world's demand for petroleum.
Yeah, Bob, I think that's a good segue into an issue here. There's always a simmering debate on energy policy in Washington, but with events in the Middle East right now, I think issues of energy security are going to take on new prominence in 2011, and let's hope that issue doesn't get worse there, but if it does, we are going to be into a serious debate in many countries about energy security. And you know, this is a big year for the U.S. and discussion about where we go next on promoting the industry. One of the issues I want to throw to the panel here is the future of government support for our industry and where do we go from here. There's discussions about VTEC in other countries. There's discussions about different support mechanisms for the industry. But I think the starting point for that dialogue really is what I mentioned off the top, $400 billion in subsidies to the oil industry. And I think that's the starting point for this discussion because the energy sector, we play a role in the energy sector, and tinkering around the edges with VTEC and whatnot is all very interesting, but there's a much bigger debate that has to happen. And in the context of reducing those oil subsidies and supporting those industries that are going to deliver real value for the economy and for the environment, where do you see, and we'll throw it to you, Rob, and then maybe Gord, about where the future of government support is going, and is there any consensus whatsoever on what that might look like?
Well, Bliss, I like your jump to the future, but I would like to stay in the present, if you don't mind, because they're talking trade, but I want to talk trade as well. It's interesting what Mark is saying, that 30 years of leadership, maturity, well, then we are a good company because we are just 1 year old. So we, if someone is entitled to duties, it is us, really. I think this whole discussion on whether we should take away duties, import duties, it's a non-issue. We shouldn't discuss it. We shouldn't touch it at all. I don't believe in the concept of free trade. I think it's a kind of a miracle, ideal situation we will never achieve. It's about fair trade. Fair trade is key. And therefore, coming back to, because Europe is always very receptive for all ethanol coming from either the United States or Brazil, we don't mind trade as long as it's fair. So if you're going to use national subsidies to promote your trade, we're utterly against it. And what we see now is that we're getting a lot of imports from the United States. Bob has taken over the position of Marcus, I would say. Okay, but don't use your VTEC to do this, because we will take legal action. We will not accept that. We cannot have subsidies interfering in trade issues. That's a flag I would like to raise here. Well, looking to the future then.
Can I just comment on that real quick?
Sure. He's not going to let that one go.
Yeah.
Okay, look, fair enough.
Rob, I agree with you that VTEC should not be exported. That was not the intent of
right.
it. And we don't believe that there is much of that that is going on. There may be some traders that are, but we have worked with the ITC and others in the government to try to determine just how significant some of that activity is. And nobody can find out exactly how much it is. But clearly, the intention of our tax incentive program right now is not to allow it to be exported. And we'll gladly work with you to try to address that situation. But I would encourage you as well to look at your own tariff schedule, because the fact of the matter is E90 coming into Europe receives a much lower duty rate, and that's what is encouraging some of that activity to occur. The 397 million gallons of ethanol that were exported last year, about a third of that did go to Europe, but all of that, we know, did not get any benefit from VTEC. There may be some additional volumes going in another category of the harmonized code that is, but Rob, you are the one that has the power on this one, because if you were to change the tariff schedule for the EU, not to provide the incentive for folks to blend, it wouldn't be an issue. So I'll be glad to help you address the EU tariff schedule if you wish.
Well, can I respond quickly?
Yep.
I think that's a very encouraging remark you're making, Bob, and I'm glad that you see it that way. If I had only had the power to change that, because I can't. I mean, I'm dealing with regulators, 27 member states, you know, it's quite complicated. Yeah. But you're right, we need to fix that at our end of the line, and we're working on that. But I'm very happy that you're saying VTEC.
Hold on one second. Sure? I want to make sure every reporter in the room heard that, that we have to work
Rachel,
on it in Europe. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and if you think Europe's complicated, try getting something done in Washington. Rob, do you want to talk about the future, and then we'll flip it to Gord and talk about where we think governments are going in the future with respect to our industry?
Me or?
Yeah, Gord?
I'm happy to jump into the middle of this, you know, loving, warm discussion between my friends together. I mean, the good thing about Canada is we're just a quiet, small, friendly nation of 35 million folks, which I am happy to say has entered into the national ethanol world with our first mandate that kicked into effect on December the 15th of last year. So we now have a national mandate that has come into effect. We freely built out the development and capacity to be able to meet that mandate. We have some exports of ethanol going into the U.S. market. We have U.S. ethanol coming into the Canadian market under NAFTA. That is our world. It is a utopia of a free trade environment that I think would be the envy of the rest of my panelists here in terms of the great relationship that we continue to have, obviously, between the Canada and the U.S. market. But to go to Bliss's point about the future, and that's really something that is at the top of all of our agendas when you think about the world that we're in right now. Oil is now, what, over $95 a barrel today? In light of the very serious issues facing the Middle East right now, and the capacity to see over $100 barrel oil which we have not seen since 2008, is going to be a very real outcome for us fairly soon. And we are likely to be in some serious issues as it relates to meeting the global energy demand that is going forward. What you don't see here on the panel are the two largest countries in the world that are driving the most of that energy demand growth over the next two decades, and that's China and India. And the consequences that our economies are going to face with just the sheer magnitude of facing that energy growth is going to be pretty significant. And what organizations like the International Energy Agency are telling us is that our capacity to meet that growth, 40% growth in the next two decades, isn't going to be met through traditional forms of energy. And therefore, the folks in this room and the contribution that we make in the transportation sector is going to be even that much more critical. And so we can have the friendly barbs and discussions that we're having here amongst us, and I think that's all good and entertaining for us all. But the reality is the collective that we need to be looking at is how do we ensure that there is a greater demand for our fuel, not just because of our own self-interest, but for the fact that the demand is going to be there and our capacity to be organized and our capacity to be able to go out, build that initial production that's going to be required to meet that is going to be critical. But so Gore, I actually agree with Bob. I think Gore, we've got a lot more common than we have in good, and I think that's where our focus is going to need to be.
What do you see as the role of government, though, Rob, and, or Gordon and Rob? Like, where's the government in all this? There isn't an energy form in the world that isn't subsidized, whether it's nuclear, coal, natural gas. I mean, there's government support behind all of these industries in one form or another. What is the future role for biofuels? Is it, you know, we get worried because politicians get nervous about a few bad stories. But in terms of this energy debate and what industries we get behind, where is the government role in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, just real quick, though. I mean, listen, I mean, you know, coming from a country in Canada and the Canadians that are still in the room, you put the words national energy and program together and you're going to see a cringe, particularly in Western Canada. You know, it'll harken back to the Trudeau days in which, you know, they tried to control the development of energy, you know, on a Canadian basis. You know, the reality is going to be this. We, our partners in the oil industry, our partners in all forms of energy, need to seriously look at what our energy framework is going to look like going forward in the next 20 years. I think the role for government is to bring all forms of energy together and talk seriously about where those demands are going to go. Because, folks, don't underestimate what we saw in 2008 and the impact of $147 barrel of oil had on every aspect of our economic reality, and therefore thinking about what the impact of $200 barrel oil or more is going to have, I think is going to sober up a lot of folks within government to have a serious conversation about where energy demand needs to go.
Rob, do you see in Europe member states continuing to support the development of biofuels and as part of this debate?
Yes, and there is no other option. It's quite simple. It's clear that we need government backing. If we don't have government backing, we're out of business. It's end of game. But what we see is that there have been put up some quite ambitious targets in terms of reducing emissions from transport. And if you look at what member states are saying at the one hand, and at the other hand, the oil and the car industry, they see no other option but biofuels. The member states had to present recently what they call the National Renewable Action Plans. So what are they going to do until 2020? And even though some of these plans will probably be made on the back of an envelope, you see that biofuels is going to be the major contributor to achieving those emission targets. Electricity, I mean, the oil industry hates electricity. That's not really an option. It will be marginal. And so will, by the way, second generation. It's all marginal. It will be coming from first generation biofuels industry. So the prognosis is very, very good. So for the next decade, I hope that we will get there unless issues like ILUC are going to interfere and will put additional burdens upon the industry. But that's probably another issue you want to address.
Bob, you're dealing with this front and center here in Washington on what might transpire over the coming 12 months for the biofuels industry with respect to government getting behind the industry or staying behind the industry. How do you see this debate playing out on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think $5 gasoline changes everything. In the absence of that, I think legislative vehicles to do much policy on energy policy is going to be difficult. I talked about that a fair amount yesterday. I am intent upon trying to stimulate a broader conversation about energy policy, because I think a myopic focus on whether you like or dislike the ethanol tax incentive is just so limiting as to not be terribly constructive. And the fact of the matter is, as long as we in the United States continue to provide significant support to a very mature industry that has a monopoly over our energy industry, and as long as world subsidies for oil are in the range that they are right now, $400 billion a year, there is no free market for energy.
Right.
You can't find an energy resource anywhere in the globe that isn't the beneficiary of some government policy. Why is that? Because energy is just so darn important to everybody's economy and where they want to go from an environmental perspective, if those are important issues. So we need to broaden the conversation and not get so focused on, you know, the interesting warfare that might break out occasionally amongst us, and do indeed try to focus on the bigger issues.
Let me go ahead, Marcos.
It's just to make a point here. I think that we always had and we still have a common agenda on many issues. The main point is that oil is becoming scarce. Oil is very problematic. You saw what happened after the disaster in the Gulf, in the Mexican Gulf. You are seeing what's happening now in the Arab countries in terms of the movements. So it will be problematic in the future. And we have the climate change discussions, and we need to replace oil, and we are probably one of the only concrete solutions that we have today. And in our case in Brazil, we had a big investments in the last 4 or 5 years, starting with greenfields from 2006 to 2008, and that's why we saw so much expansion of production. And after the financial crisis of 2008, we had a rearrangement of the industry, where one-fifth of the industry was touched by the crisis. And that's why right now we don't see expansion in our industry, because most of the investments go to brownfields, goes to existing facilities. And now we have an industry which is completely different of what we had 6 years ago or 4 years ago. So this time of adaptation, I think it's extremely good and makes our industries much more competitive. But one point that's important is that if we look at our 35 years of ethanol, and we have a long story, we eliminated the subsidies on the 90s. Most of the subsidies, and we eliminated the tariff. And I believe that those conditions are necessary to have a competitive industry. If we didn't eliminate that, we would never be competing internationally. And I think that the U.S. will need to do the same, and many other countries too. It's impossible to continue to have an industry which is protected. If Bob says that he will try to reach international markets, means that In some way, countries will need to reduce their tariffs. Oil is free in the world. Why ethanol will be protected everywhere? We are talking about agricultural commodities. We are talking about feedstocks. We can have climate changes. We can have climate problems in different countries. And it makes sense that in years where we have problems in sugarcane in Brazil, we would import corn ethanol. In years that you have problem in U.S., you would import sugarcane ethanol.
Which we've done.
Yes, and I think that we should do more and more. I don't see any reason that we would have our policies only concentrated in one feedstock. I think that we should have our open markets for all feedstocks. Probably in the beginning of the industry, it makes some sense that you have some protection. But when you become a big producer, a big exporter, it doesn't make any sense anymore. The main policy that you need here is the mandate to blend ethanol. you don't need the subsidy anymore, and you are changing the subsidy. And if you are changing the subsidy, my question to you, Bob, is that last year you said that you are favorable to parity. You always said that the tariff existed because of the subsidy. And you said that if the subsidy was 45 cents per gallon, the tariff could go to 45 cents too. So this year, if the subsidy goes to zero, because it will be replaced by some by something else, are you ready to defend the parity to zero tariff?
Okay, next year. I was going to change the subject, but there's no way I can do that now. Yeah. Next year, if we do this panel, I'm bringing a bell with me. Okay, so Bob, you got that look in your eye, and then George.
There's a lot to respond to. Let me go real quick. First of all, I love you, Marcus, because you just made my argument. Because you acknowledge that we have indeed imported Brazilian ethanol when the market has supported it. So clearly then, our existing tax and trade policy is not a barrier to entry, number one. Number two, we absolutely have been supportive of parity and will continue to do so, but that doesn't really address George's point earlier that the tariff was noticed under WTO. It is a separate and distinct entity, and while we support parity, there are other energy and environmental reasons for it. But putting that aside, my question for you was, is the reduction in sugarcane ethanol that we're seeing today a consequence of the economic crisis that you just referred to, or is it a consequence of two things? One, just weather, because the crops haven't been as robust, but two, the fact that your country is now investing in offshore oil drilling. To what extent have the discoveries of oil offshore in Brazil dampened the enthusiasm for renewable fuels in Brazil?
I think that the problem was the crisis in 2008 that really touched part of the industry, and most of the investors came to Brazil and saw that was cheaper to invest in brownfields instead of going to greenfields. Greenfields are far from the ports. We have infrastructure problems, and it was very easy to buy brownfields in Brazil. And the second point that made our exports difficult is the overvaluation of the real compared to the dollar. So it makes our exports much more difficult. So these are the main points. I really believe that in the future, we are going to have a new cycle of investments, and this is exactly what we are seeing now. It's a possibility of a new cycle. We also had some climate problems in 2010 and 2011.
Just because I can tell that Bliss is going to ring that bell, yep, whether he has it or not. Plínio Nastaria, another good friend of mine from Brazil today, said that next year's ethanol production was probably going to be even lower than this year's. Do you agree with his assessment?
No, this year, 2011, it will repeat last year's, more or less. Most of the people are saying that. Next year's, we don't know because it's...
Okay, George, weigh in on this one quickly, and then we'll switch to a new topic before...
Okay. Given that prediction that the sugar ethanol production is not going to be as big as this year, suggests that you will not have hundreds of millions of gallons of anhydrous to export to the United States when that tariff is removed. So you got to be careful what you wish for when you go and push for the removal of the tariff, because you're not in a situation to deliver on all that promise of supplying the U.S. market with large quantities. But I come back to that point, it just won't happen. As they say from Southern Virginia, this dog just cannot hunt. You can talk about parity all you want, but the State Department and the Special Trades Representative Office have a box. I call it the lock box. It's called the Other Duties and Charges box, where in 1994, every country said, all this goes in, it's protected, anybody got a complaint, say it now, forever hold your peace, you can't say it 20 years later. It's locked up. It stays there. I should have brought Exhibit A. a letter from Secretary of State Clinton and Ambassador Ron Kirk of STR. I think last year. in response to congressional inquiry, we will continue to support the 54-cent gallon import tariff. So rather than go down that path and create trade hostilities, I come back to the other point. But before I do that, I want to interject something, because you'll be fascinated by this. You would think that the small, little developing countries in the Caribbean basin would be the ones with the most support, with the most subsidies. We have the least subsidies on ethanol of anybody here. It's wide open. U.S. ethanol is now flowing into Jamaica. We don't have what some people will call the most egregious trade barrier, the non-tariff technical barrier, the one that can stifle trade in a heartbeat more than a tariff, and that is having different specifications for imports versus domestic. And that's going on right now. So please, let's all get together and recognize the goal is to work together. So Brazil launched the Caribbean Basin Initiative, and let's work together in using our capacity and strengthening our relationships.
Thanks, George. So let's switch gears a little bit here to another issue, one that's far less divisive, which is indirect land use change. Everybody up here has to deal with this issue in one form or another. We've got a lot of different views on ILUC, as we call it, from the various representative governments. Brazil was way out ahead of this many years ago. But maybe I'll throw this to Gord, because being a Canadian, I'm familiar with the views of the Canadian government and some provincial governments on ILUC. Maybe Gord, just we'll keep it a little tight, but ILUC in Canada doesn't seem to be something that's causing a lot of heartburn for policymakers.
Well, in terms of the national mandate that came into effect on December the 15th, there is no indirect land use factor applied to that mandate at all, and that was a deliberate decision of the Government of Canada with respect to that factor being applied. British Columbia is the only province in Canada so far to have a low-carbon fuel standard that is now in place. It came into effect in 2010. They were part of a joint memorandum of understanding between the state of California, the government of British Columbia, and the government of Ontario. And the intent of that MOU was to follow the lead of California as it relates to the development of low-carbon fuel strategy, except where they broke on the issue of indirect land use. And again, the government of British Columbia said, no, we will not apply and use an ill-informed science to impose regulation on the biofuels industry. They reserve the right to revisit that decision in the future, but the reality, based on certainly my view of some of the success that we've had in California and the work of the expert working group, effort, I think we've demonstrated, and we're continue to demonstrate, the fact that that is flawed policy that should not be informing regulatory decisions by government.
Rob, you're probably on the other end of the spectrum with the ILUC issues in Europe. Very aggressive on the policy side.
Yes, I fear you might be right on that one. That's another goodie we got from the United States, actually, because it was searching who came up with this great plan. And as a lawyer, he's really brilliant, I must say. I've seen him operating several times. He's maybe not that good of a scientist, but as a lawyer, he's great. And unfortunately, in Europe, there are people who truly believe in him and believe that he has found the way to discredit biofuels. We happen to have in Europe people that are, well, quite green, and there is a European commissioner from Denmark who believes that there needs to be applied an ILUC factor on the industry. And even though there are enough scientists who say that the models being used are not adequate, still she believes that it is adequate enough to apply this ILUC factor. So we now are approaching the final moment of truth, I would say. We are not far from it. Most likely in July there will be a bill on the table that is going to maybe decide that there needs to be an ILUC factor applied. So this lady believes strongly in what CARB has been doing, and therefore it's very, very welcome that recent research done by the expert group of CARB says, well, the numbers are wrong, it needs to go down. So if you look at how this is developing, this science on iLook, we started off, I don't know how many grams it was, that searching came up 180 or I don't know exactly. It was a huge number. And over time, we are progressing that way. So finally, we hit zero. And hopefully, we hit it before July, because that will be welcome. That will be welcome.
Marcos, on iLook issues, I think Brazil had to deal with some of this stuff some number of years ago. I guess there are pressures on rainforest issues. From a policy perspective, is that a big issue you're facing now, or is that behind you?
I believe that the question about land use changes, direct and indirect land use changes, were extremely important on the discussions about greenhouse gas emissions. And this was a very important focus of our industry in the last 3 years. We've been really working hard in the U.S., in EPA, in California, in Europe, trying to convince the regulators that that most of the models had problems and that the numbers for sugarcane were not correct. And I think that most of those numbers were corrected. There's still lots of numbers to be revised. The methodologies, especially in Europe, are not transparent. Right now there are 5 or 6 models in Europe competing themselves, and so it's extremely complicated. But I think that this issue will one day be solved. The big problem today, I think, in my opinion, will be the food versus fuel debate again, because we are going to face a period of high prices in the world, and I believe that the accusations against the biofuel industry will come as they were before the financial crisis in 2007.
Yeah,
well
that's a great segue, because I wanted to go there next. The food for fuel issue is something that we've been living with for a few years, and I think we'll be living with forever. But I think the nature of the debate's changing a little bit. Some of the accusations today are not going untested, as they were a few years ago, because we put research out, others have put research out, and the facts just don't stand up as well as they did 2 years ago when they were unchallenged. Bob, where do you think this is going? Grain prices are very high. We don't, as I heard John Urbanchuk on the AgriTalk radio say earlier, we don't have food inflation yet here in North America, but they certainly have it in India and China, and it seems to be barreling down the tracks again at us, or are we wrong? Where are we at in the U.S. on this issue?
Well, I think you're right that the media and some of our critics will be a little bit more careful not to jump on that bandwagon with quite as much enthusiasm as they did in 2008 because, in part with the work of the global RFA, working with the World Bank and others, we've had them relook at that issue. And clearly the conclusion has been it wasn't biofuels that was driving food inflation in 2008. It was everything else that we were talking about. It was speculation in the marketplace. It was weather-related events. And more than anything else, it was the price of oil. And when the World Bank came out recently and sort of affirmed that that was indeed the case and said that the impact of biofuels was very small, I think it embarrassed a few folks that had jumped out on that issue a bit prematurely, and I think they're going to be careful not to do that again. That said, I've been hearing the food versus fuel argument for 30 years, and it's not going to go away.
Right.
It's louder today because the nature of media is different today. It's louder today because our industry is bigger today. It's louder because we're an easier target. But I think we just have to keep doing what we've been doing and trying to educate folks and make sure that that doesn't become the drag on our industry that it became in 2008. That's going to take a collective effort. And much as Brazil might really enjoy sort of this food versus fuel debate, ultimately it's not about food, it is about land. And,
right.
I made that point repeatedly. And that will bring Brazil right back into the debate. It brings other feedstocks back into the debate and complicates the continued growth and evolution of this industry in a very real way.
Rob, you've got to face this issue in Europe regularly. The NGOs there have quite a bit of influence in government and very powerful.
They have a lot of ears of people within Brussels and within their member state governments. I mentioned the 50 million hectares of land in Ukraine, farming land that's not being used. Where is this debate in Europe, and does that idle land play a role in this discussion, or is it back burner?
Well, it's interesting how this is covered also in Europe, I believe globally, the whole food and fuel issue. It has far less attention to the fact that we are seen as causing it. I mean, it's hardly covered in any European media. I was really surprised. And maybe it has to do with the fact that, looking back at what happened 2 years ago, we see things in perspective now. At that time, we didn't see it as perspective. And people are very cautious now to accuse us as having caused this, because what happened was pretty obvious. We always say, don't forget that we are also producing food in the form of animal feed. And that's easily rejected or not known. And we keep repeating that issue. Also, and as Bob clearly says, I mean, it's a land issue. We keep saying, hold on, we are producing food at the same time. And that needs to be taken into consideration, even if you discuss ILUC or food and fuel. And then what we see in Europe is that we have a constant increase of idle land. We are taking land out of production. We have reformed our sugar beet policy. It delivered 1 million hectares of land unused. At least we can use it for different purposes. So it's this whole discussion is so emotional. It's so from the belly. It's not good.
Gordon, you lived through the discussion 2 years ago in Canada. We have lots of land. We seem to get most of our negative press in Canada from south of the border, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, stuff like that. Where is the debate now in Canada? Is it changing? I recall not seeing a ton of press on this year, but we've got issues with high grain prices, so the worry is it's coming back.
No, I mean, I think, you know, we, as Bob said, we have a job to do to continue to inform media and inform government decision makers on the reality of opportunity and where we're going. I mean, one of the things that we should not ever apologize is for what we are attempting to contribute to our friends in the agriculture sector. You know, governments have brought this policy in place quite deliberately. You know, if there is more land becoming idle, it's because farmers couldn't make a living growing the grains that they were doing, and were doing so at a price that was well below the cost of production. So there should be no apology for the fact that there was a deliberate strategy by collectively our governments to embrace a renewable fuel strategy, in part to deliver new opportunities for the agriculture sector. Yeah. That hasn't stopped our friends in the food industry, despite record profits, claiming that somehow we are out there, you know, significantly disrupting the food marketplace. Thank you. Pretty ill-informed. Would like to see that, you know, at a time when grain prices, you know, dropped in 2008 as extensively as they did, the cost of the food that you and I purchased didn't go down one penny. So, you know, I think, it's, you know, it's as Bob said, and you've alluded to, Bliss, and others, I mean, it's an issue that we will continue to face. I think it's critical for us to continue to get the facts out, to talk about the positive contribution that we are making to the agriculture sector. I think in Canada, particularly in Western Canada, we are fortunate. We have an agriculture minister that comes from Saskatchewan. He knows the issue very well. He continues to be the strongest voice and advocate within the Canadian government in supporting, you know, the renewable fuel strategy, and I think we'll continue to do so going forward.
Great.
For sure.
Bob, you want to comment before
just real quick, because I think about land use. I think it's important for us to remember it's not just what land is being used, how many acres are coming in or out. It's also about how that land is being used, because at the end of the day, it's about productivity. And, you know, we are getting far better yields on every acre of land because of technology. And while none of us should be responsible for our country's policies on certain things, I'm going to challenge Rob a little bit, because the Europeans have fought technology every step of the way. And as a consequence, they are not maximizing the productivity of the land that they are, in fact, using. And so before they try to go after biofuels and penalize biofuels for some environmental impact, they ought to look at their own policies and recognize that they are at fault for not allowing technology to maximize yields and maximize productivity on those acres that they do have in use.
You're suggesting agricultural reform in Europe?
It's a crazy notion, I know. And I think Rob probably agrees with me on that point.
It's an issue
that he has to fight. But at the end of the day, I hope he's successful in getting people to focus as much on how the land is being used as what land is being used.
Bob, I couldn't agree more with you. Sorry, Max. It's unfortunate that we have that view on how to apply new technology in getting productivity increased. But it's an issue we as an industry cannot touch. I mean, if we're going to do that, we will be a double-cross fight. I mean, it's ILUC, it's food, fuel. If you would say, well, maybe you should change your views on GMO, I mean, then we better pack our stuff immediately. We're out of business. I mean, we do not touch it. We do not touch it. I mean, we just look in the sky and say, well, okay, it's not our issue.
We've got about 9 minutes here, and what I would like to end on is the way we ended. We did this panel last year and during the Winter Olympics, and I asked everybody to make two predictions. One, a prediction for the industry for 2011, and number two, who was going to win the gold medal for the men's hockey at the Olympics. I should remind most of you that you got it all wrong. Marcos was talking about soccer. Bob thought that the women's U.S. team was going to win the gold medal game.
And I won.
Gord got it right, of course, because
God bless
just
Sydney
for
Crosby.
The record, Canada did win the gold medal game. But I'll ask you to...
God bless Sydney Crosby.
I'll ask you guys to make two predictions. One, and be courageous. Don't give us lame predictions. A courageous prediction for the industry this year. And number two, what's the price of oil going to be on January 1st of next year?
You want
to start?
January 1.
What's the price of oil gonna
be? George?
My prediction, and hopefully it's not too bold and courageous, is that we will see a Caribbean Basin Initiative from Brazil, that they will recognize that it's a complete dead end to go down this path of trying to open up the ODC lockbox and create all this antagonism leading to trade hostilities. And instead, reach out to the Caribbean Basin neighbors and say, we want to work with you. You've got all this capacity. This is the best way for us to get to the U.S. market. You're well established. You have all these linkages and all this infrastructure. That's my prediction. I'm Marcus. I hope you're taking notes. Thank you. And I look forward to taking that up later.
What oil price?
I embarrass myself by picking a number. I just don't. I just don't follow it that closely.
Okay.
Bob, of course, I would defer to Bob's number.
How about predicting the price of rum next year? Bob.
I don't know where to go with that. I thank George for being on message today. Look, I have great confidence that this industry is going to continue to grow and evolve. There are going to be policy debates this year, and it'll be entertaining, but at the end of the year, there'll be a framework in place, I'm confident, that is going to allow the industry to continue to grow. I'm looking forward to this year seeing the development of the cellulosic ethanol industry, other advanced ethanol fuels developing. I think we're going to have some serious policy fights on issues like greenhouse gas scoring and others, but I'm confident that the industry continues to grow. In part because I'm very pessimistic about oil. I am concerned about the volatility in the Middle East. I wonder where that continues to grow. I talked about yesterday if just 2 million barrels threatened, 2 million barrels a day moving through the Suez Canal being threatened, you know, spikes gasoline prices as they did. What happens if that volatility spreads to further in the Middle East? And the 50 million barrels a day that flow through the Strait of Hormuz is threatened. You know, yesterday we heard a couple of speakers, including Tom Clauser, who I think is highly respected, and would have a better sense of any of us of where oil prices go, suggest that you could have, you know, $400, $500 barrel oil if things blow up over there. I'm not going to suggest that that's where things are going, but I think we're looking at triple-digit oil prices for a while. There's a new reality. China and India aren't going away, and I think it just spells more and more demand for our product.
Great. Marcos?
Right,
be courageous.
Now I have...
Be courageous in your prediction.
Yes. There are now 4 years that I work for this industry, and before coming to this industry, I was a professor at the university, and now I am working in something that I think it's one of the most dynamic sectors in the world. It's dynamic in terms of technology. Sugarcane in Brazil is the oldest activity we have. It's the oldest economic activity, but today it's an extremely dynamic industry in terms of moving to the fuels world, to the electricity world. We are talking more and more about plastics. We just had, for example, meetings with Coca-Cola about the plant bottle technology, which is fabulous. It's not only food and fuel, it's food and fuel and electricity and plastics. It's so many new issues. So technologically, we have a huge frontier, probably comparable to what we had 2 decades ago on the computers, on the cell phones. So I think that we need to first consider that. We are in the middle of this revolution, and I think that we are thinking here very, very narrowly. I think that we should think much more broadly, first of all. So technologically, it's much more important than what we are saying. Second, the players. Even if we have differences between us here, we are talking about national trade associations here. But more and more, my associates are also Bob associates and Rob associates. When I arrived here the first day, Bob said that he was happy because the sugar barons in Brazil were driving cars with corn ethanol. Who are the sugar barons today in Brazil? ADM, Bunge, Cargill, Dreyfus, Shell. These are the sugar barons today. So more and more, it makes no sense to see frontiers, to see policies. I think one of the only areas that we didn't move, the private sector moved. It's moving to the places where they can invest, where they can have profits. And we need to move also, to move in the direction of the right policies. I am completely sure that you needed to reform the VTC. The VTC makes no sense anymore. You need to find something else, much more intelligent. Yesterday, I saw some proposals here which are more intelligent in terms of infrastructure, blender pumps, in terms of V15, in terms of flex fuels. So we need to think together about alternatives for the flex fuel. We need to think about having ethanol markets, a competition, a global competition on that. So I really believe that this is our target this year. It's to have competition in the ethanol market. Thank you.
Next year, we got to invest in a bell.
I want to bring him to the Senate because he already knows how to filibuster.
It's warning time.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to go over.
Rob, how about you?
Okay, I will make some prediction. One, no more E90 imports by the end of this year. Yeah, I write it down, please.
You can't get these guys off message. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly.
And two, the ILUC issue will be resolved in Europe to our favor. Maybe not for all biofuels, but I'm sure that ethanol will come out good. Three, we will see an increase in production and consumption with at least 10%, if not 15%. Price of oil. Oh, and one more. The VTEC will survive with one new clause, not for export. And then, on the old price, are we talking West Texas or Brent?
Pick one.
Pick.
Brent.
Brent. Three digits, for sure, because it's already there. It will go in line with inflation. Add another 5-10 cents max.
Interesting. I think we're going to see some interesting things. I'm going to say something ambitious like corn yields are going to start predictably exceeding 200 bushels an acre going forward. We're going to see an ever-increasing demand and use of grains on a global basis. And therefore, I think the innovation and the capacity for our agriculture sector to continue to surprise us, I think farmers in the United States and farmers in Canada and elsewhere will continue to be the best that they are in doing what they do and continue to surprise us in terms of the advancements and the contribution they're going to be making. So I think it's, you know, we're going to continue to see that credible innovation within the agriculture sector going forward in 2011 and going forward, and I welcome seeing that happen and the continued partnership that we have within that sector benefiting all of us. You know, coming from Canada and the energy dominance that traditional oil has in our economy, I mean, sure. I mean, I think it's very conceivable we're going to see triple-digit oil going forward. And one last prediction, if I'm fortunate enough to be at this panel discussion this time next year, we're going to have the commercialization of the first municipal waste ethanol plant in Canada in operation in the city of Edmonton, which I'm going to be pretty excited about being able to applaud at the beginning of 2012, which is going to further demonstrate the innovation and capacity that this industry has for the contribution that we are making going forward to meet our future energy needs. And lastly, that my good friend Marcos is a very visible and productive partner within the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance and working with us on the issues that, quite frankly, are bigger than what separates us and more importantly, advancing the cause for us going forward.
Clearly, Gordon and I spend way too much time together because he stole both my predictions. I get, I'm fortunate enough to get the last word. In terms of predictions, he literally did steal them. I was going to speak about Enercam and their commercial plant in Edmonton being the first in the world commercially operational in Edmonton. And secondly, I was going to make the brave, very courageous prediction that Unica would be a proud member of the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance and working side by side with us. As you can see, you can imagine what the board meetings are like with the Global Alliance. They were tame today. I want to end on a positive note by saying, though, that we all here have a very, very important role to play in fostering that debate about energy policy and the support for our industry. These guys do it better than anybody. And I hope we continue to do it with a unified voice, because without that unified voice, we have a significantly smaller chance of getting the job done. So I want to please join me in thanking these great panelists once again.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.